latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Amazing achievements for Pennsylvania breeds on the world stage. Thanks to Finest City, Unique Bella, and Shamrock Rose, PA joins Kentucky as the only state in the past decade to breed Eclipse Award champions three straight years. Add that to our unmatched incentives. Plus, our racehorse development fund can only be used to support PA breeding and racing. Why breed anywhere else? This is Brian Sanfratello. Go to PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up at ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
If your hand will take me home, your next move is always slow. Now I can't wait anymore. Don't wanna go, don't wanna stay, don't wanna make a change. Don't wanna show, don't wanna cheat, don't wanna hesitate.
We're back at the races. Well, the jackpot for Noble Mission. What a important win for him when it came to Code of Honor and the Travers to get an American. I mean, it's a quasi classic, mile and a quarter this time of year. And yeah, we talked on Monday with Shug, but we really didn't get in other than other than to reference the slight bemusement that Shug had at receiving a noble mission. And he said, what are they sending me this for? Sending me a noble mission. Well, he's made the most of it. And not to mention the fact that the Colt may late May fall. And for him to do what he's done, he'd already kind of, you know, exceeded some expectation, I imagine. There's Sid Fernando joining us. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. Sid, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Sid, first, before we talk about Noble Mission and what this means for him and for his prospects going into next season, but your overall impressions of the race?
Well, you know, I guess something that we touched upon several of these horses the week before. You know, it was kind of an open race, and I guess I was the most surprised with maybe I shouldn't have been, but the early speed of Tacitus, which was kind of surprising. You know, he's a horse that should eventually get a grade one race on his resume, and you know, he's a potential stallion for Judmont. But the race, I mean, really set up for Noble Mission. It seemed like that outer part of the track, visually anyway, was playing really well, and the horse is wide. You know, he's had a great race, and just kind of confirming. And as you pointed out, the late foal maturing, and kind of confirming his last few races too. So it was, it was a worthy winner, I think.
Well, and in a lot of ways, it just a display of Shug's, you know, just tremendous management of a horse, and
absolutely.
I mean, that to me, knowing, for starters, I mean, the way in which he broke out as a 2-year-old, and you didn't necessarily, we are pointing out that he was a May foal and physically, in terms of age, younger than anybody in the field and all that, and really younger than any of the prominent members of the crop. However, he broke his maiden August 18th. Last year, as a 2-year-old, and he did it at First Asking, going 6 furlongs. And, given the way Shug trains and given that pedigree, you really wouldn't, you wouldn't necessarily expect him to be successful. I mean, a lot of times that quickly, because Shug, notably, we've talked about this with him for years, Sid, when he's got a precocious horse with some speed, he generally debuts them at 7/8. And because invariably he's acknowledging that they may need that extra furlong. So for this horse, who's now a 1.25 mile winner, and who, of course, was going to hit the board in the Derby, even without being elevated by the DQ, for him to have this kind of success and be a first out 6 furlong winner really speaks to his quality and his versatility. The way Shug got him to here from there says a lot.
Yeah, that's well said. Especially when you think about the sire, he's a full brother to Frankel, but he just made 1 start at 2. He was 2nd. At 3, he was a Group 3 winner, Steve. At 4, he had a kind of a weak season, but they brought him back at 5, and it was really at 5 that he won 5 of 7 starts, including 3 Group 1 races in Europe, 2 at 10 furlongs, and 1 at 1.5 miles. He was a much later developing colt than Sanko. He was also a much more of a staying colt than Sanko. The pedigree is, really, it's very stamina-oriented, and when you take into account a horse like that at stud here, he's putting a lot of stamina into his offspring. Code of Honor has a speedier female line, which one of the things we talked about last week was you take a stallion like Noble Mission and you try to put more speed into it, and the female family is a lot speedier. It's some of the dam is a stakes winner, Group 3 winner by Dixie Union, who also stood at Lane's End. The second dam is a stakes winner by Mount Livermore, who was a very fast horse. And the third dam is by Bull Forbes, though he was a Derby and Belmont winner, is known for his speed. So there's a lot of speed in this family as far as the sires are structured, and then some of the black type winners within the pedigree have shown a lot of speed. In fact, Code of Honor's graded placed half brother Big League by Spikestown, he was second in the Best Pal Stakes. Was third in the San Pedro, fast horse. So there's a lot of speed. So it was, kudos to the breeder and owner, Will Farish, because he stands the horse, Noble Mission, and bred this colt. It was put up for sale and at the Keeneland September sale, and it was, I believe, it was like $70,000 RNA. And so we kept him. The colt is obviously, a May 23rd foal, a smaller physical specimen. Probably didn't get the attractions based on those physical aspects, as well as a pedigree that's not particularly strong. It just tells you why this game is so intriguing. It's difficult to predict. And here's a case. And to compare it to another winner on the day, you pointed out how the Night Bazoo was a RNA, $19,000 RNA. So, you've had two RNAs here come out and win the Grade 1 races.
Before we talk about what this means for Noble Mission, who stands for 15,000 at Lane's End, there is something about Saturday's, not really just the result, but even the way the day was lining up for Will Farish. And he also had the homebred highest honors in the race.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The commonality here, Highest Honors Dam, Tap Your Feet by Dixieland Band. And when I look at Code of Honor and I see Reunited, a daughter of Dixie Union, a son of Dixieland Band. Is Farish got a little preference for the Northern Dancer Dixieland Band broodmare line opportunities?
Yeah, well, Dixieland Band was a Northern Dancer horse that was campaigned off, going off memory, I believe, by his father-in-law, and was an early stallion at Lane's End, Bayard Sharp, I believe.
Yeah.
Of course, Dixieland Band's best stallion son was Dixie Union, was also at Lane's End. Dixie Union's son, Union Rags, is at Lane's End. And Dixie Union died prematurely, but he's now turning into an exceptional broodmare sire as well. So he was he's a fast horse as well, in that mile and 16th mile in the eighth range. And yeah, it's, you can say that the Dixieland Band, Dixie Union line is particularly close to the to Mr. Farish. If you look at another horse on the day that he bred, that's Catalina Cruiser, Union Rags, Dixie Union, Dixieland Band.
Well, and even another, you even had a, you had a Union Rags son in the Travers in Laughing Fox.
That's right. That's right. So, the astute observation here, but yeah, that is, that's how the, that particular line of Lorna Dancer came to be at Lane's End, and it's been cultivated, and it was no surprise when Bill Farish, Will's son, went after Union Rags when he went to stud. I think that was like a $13 million stallion. And, you know, he's done extremely well. They're still waiting on Catalina Cruiser to become a G1 winner, but once he does, I think his young horse will have five G1 winners in you know, a small number of crops. So, yeah, they're still, you know, quite developing that stallion. The Farishes, you know, have a classic bent to them, obviously. Very blue-blooded breeders in that sense. And I think it was a big thing, and now we're getting back to Noble Missions, to actually bring a son of Galileo here. And, you know, hopefully this pays more dividends for them, because this could be the first son of Galileo to have sired a G1 winner in dirt. And Noble Mission would have done something that Galileo hasn't done either, which is to get a graded stakes winner on dirt. And that's something that, you know, I think when I was in Ireland last year speaking with Aidan O'Brien, that's something that he wants to rectify as well. So, you know, it's interesting that Noble Mission got this done.
Well, and I'm just looking. This, of course, the second crop, and they're
the first crop.
No, he's from the first crop, but there are two crops are in the system, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's a total of at least for the stats that I'm looking at with from Thoroughgraph, from the sire stats. A total of 73 horses. So there isn't necessarily a and those are, that's internationally.
I think
right?
That's aren't quite right, because I think
is there more
his
than
first
that?
Crop alone. Yeah, his first crop, and I don't like to use the 2-year-old numbers in, because we really haven't had too many.
That's true.
Favorite. But if you just look at the first crop, I believe he had 107 main foals from the first crop. He's also got a European Stakes winner at a mile and a half. And so now he's got two graded stakes winners from that first crop. Like I said, this is a stallion that imparts a lot of stamina. So he's kind of against it in a way in this country, but by breeding speedier mares to this stallion, he should, if what we saw is going to be representative, he's gonna be able to have some success here. I mean, it's not easy to win a Travers winner in their first crop, obviously, and so that's really a positive sign. And I hope this horse starts to get more opportunity, Steve. You pointed out he stands for $15,000 now, which is a great deal. Started at 25, and of course, you know, these step fees go down. until a stallion starts to get some success. And hopefully, you know, a second crop, 2-year-olds of 2019 can continue with this. And I'm sure the first crop will give you more stakes in those too, because if they follow the sire, he got better as he got older.
And I'm just—I mean, for your approach, Sid, as a breeding partner, consultant with operations, where does he fit? What kind of breeders should be thinking about, you know, taking a shot with Noble Mission, and what kind of mares will get approved by Lane's End? Does that become an issue with a mid-priced stallion prospect?
Well, this is the type of horse that actually would suit the climate that we're in this country, excluding racing abroad or racing for Europe. We're starting to get more turf racing in here. We have much more distance racing on grass. The most lucrative races are on turf. You know, 40% of all graded races are on turf. And now with condition races, maiden specials, and smaller stakes races popping up to support that graded stakes program, a horse like Noble Mission is a valuable stallion for this marketplace. And, you know, Daddy Got a Horse on Dirt makes him even more appealing right now, because he's the type of horse that's now showing he can get a dirt horse and as well as that turf horse that he's the graded winner he has. I think that, again, it really comes down to Steve. Personally, I think he's a valuable horse. But with the market so consumed by the commercial elements of everything, as we talked about, with so many people breeding to the commercial marketplace, it's tough to for Lane's End, obviously, with their field, to get the type of mares they'd like to get. Given that environment. However, with the success he's having now, I'm sure he's going to be much more in demand next spring. And especially if Code of Honor continues to go forward and wins a few more races, something like that is a great catalyst for getting more mares.
Well, seems as well that Farish, based on the comments publicly and then from what Shug had to say, their intention is to keep him on the racetrack for a while. And they are certainly, you know, into next year, and Shug even had said, and Mr. Farish had even said, you know, 4 or 5. So some of that,
I can see that too.
Right? Yeah. You get the sense that it also gives a chance for Noble Mission to sort of ruminate and some more success.
And also, Noble Mission himself really didn't get to be the horse he was until he was 5. So given this horse is a late foal, and given the tendencies of his own sire, it makes complete sense to continue to race his horse. You know, if he stays sound, stays successful, he's got a lot of money to earn as well. And all of that just becomes, as you pointed out, an advertisement for his sire.
Well, the Code of Honor success, actually, Sid, could be used as a branch for two different conversations. One that I saw you were captivated with all weekend, which is Judmont related, There, you know, there's your connection to Code of Honor, Noble Mission, and Frankel, et cetera, and Judmont, and that was Kingman, but also Shug, with a story that emerged over the last couple of days regarding the Phippses and their offering of all of their male yearlings at Keeneland, and that has been that little advertisement has been circulating all over Twitter the last 48 hours, and got a couple of questions about this. The next shoe to drop, I'm curious, is it going to be a bunch of infoal mares in November?
Well, according to according to what they've tweeted, they are selling colts, but they continue to plan to breed and race. After Denny Phipps died, his daughter Daisy, her family, and various generations beneath. So, what usually happens with these dynasties is at some point they become common property of the extended families. So certain elements might want to sell, and so you sell some horses, settle people out, and then one segment might become the carrying force. If you look at what happened with Darby Dan, for example, same thing, and it was then John Phillips who became the individual that is carrying it forward. If you look at Glen Hill Farm, it's Craig Burnick, the grandson of the founder, Leonard Lavin, through Leonard Lavin's daughter, who is Craig Burnick's mom. So, there's some settling periods that take place before one or more branches continue to take over and keep going. And it's a common thing that you see over and over again. I'll take them at their word. Jill Gordon tweeted that they continue to plan to race and breed. Interestingly, they bought yearlings last year. So that's, I believe that's Daisy Phipps Polito. I think she is buying yearlings, and whatever group that they have together now, they call it the Phipps Stable. And I'm sure for estate planning purposes, it went from even during the last few years of Guinea Phipps to the Phipps Stable transitions. It used to be obviously just Guinea Phipps, and then it became the Phipps Stable. And I think Daisy is the main individual behind the Phipps Stable.
Well, I appreciate the feedback there, and then talk about Kingman, and because you were tickled. Yeah, you were all over them. That was great.
Yeah. Well, no, I wrote a blog post a few weeks ago, Kingman, comparing him to Frankel. What an embarrassment of riches for Judmont. That. They've come up with these two stallions. And so that was about 2.5 weeks ago. I wrote a blog post for the Work Thoroughbred site. And within those 2.5 weeks, I mean, Kingman has just absolutely exploded, culminating on the track this weekend with the three individual new stakes winners in one day. In the interim between that 2.5 period at Arcana, he was getting 850,000 euro yearlings, up to 850,000. Just yesterday at Goff UK, Coolmore went to 440K for a yearling, which is a sale record. He's had, you know, a run of success, including Hedman, owned by Jedmont themselves, won a Group 2, has Group 1 targets next. John Gosden as King of Comedy was fourth last out, but, you know, he's a potential Group 1 winner. There's a good two-year-old filly in France that won by 9 ranks. Not to mention, you know, he's got 14 or 15 stakes winners already. And, yeah, he's just set. Coolmore, by the way, also purchased his first crop, Sprinter Calix, from Jedmont. So they're going to stand him. Coolmore had also purchased a $1 million yearling last year, Cormorant, that won on debut. So when it's just a, it just so happened, Steve, that in that 2.5 week period since I wrote that post, Kingman's just absolutely exploded. Now my column was really comparing him with what's the gold standard for a young sire, and that's Frankel, Noble Mission's brother. Frankel had an absolutely fabulous first crop and is still the gold standard. My point just was that, you know, Frankel went to stud at $125,000 versus $55,000 for Kingman. And Frankel's at $175,000 now versus $75,000 for Kingman. So based on that value, you know, Kingman has done extraordinarily well in his own right, but even more so when you consider the difference in stud fee. So it's an exciting time for the Brits because they're coming up with another new market-based stallion that looks like, you know, he's exceptional.
Well, and we're inching closer, of course, Arrogate produce soon enough. And,
that's right. That's right.
And as we
were, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, Arrogate, you have Liam's map still to come at Lane's End. You know, We'll Take Charge has got three-year-olds at Three Chimneys, but I think everybody kind of realizes the last great hope for the excellent stallion Unbridled Song might rest with Arrogate. And Jedmont will be the farm that perhaps will make the last and really the only significant stallion by Unbridled Song if it were to happen. And so they're in charge of that. They've stood a stallion by Unbridled Song before First Defense. He's since been sold to Saudi Arabia, but Jedmont's got a really good two-year-old in Europe that's undefeated in four starts, and he's by Siskin. He's by First Defense. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with Arrogate. I know they're very serious about making that stallion, and given the track record of recent times, not only with Oasis Dream and Dan Shelley, but with most recently Frankel, Kingman, Bated Breath, another stallion they have, you know, Jedmont to Kingman at stallion making. And so if anybody's got a shot with Arrogate, Jedmont does.
Well, and kind of in a related in a related note, just circling back through Noble Mission, 34 hips, 34 offerings at Keeneland this September.
Perfect timing.
And starting actually, interestingly, starting with hip 1306. And I'm just looking at the. Just curious, looking at the catalogs, that's got to be, here we go, September grouping. They would start 13. That starts on book three. So no Noble Missions in book one or two, just starting in book three. But although, you know, you made a reference that I'm guessing that you heard that conversation with Jeff Bloom yesterday, Sid, and if operations of any size and budget want to be inspired, today's conversation too with John Terranova, as well as Jeff Bloom yesterday, you want to go into the fall feeling like, you know, no matter how much money you've got a chance. All you got to do is listen to Jeff Bloom and to John from yesterday and today. 80,000 for Midnight Bisou and a $19,000 RNA as a yearling, a modest pinhook of 50,000 when it came to Henley's Joy. Here was Funny Guy and the other one we talked about with John. I mean, it Killy Beg's Captain, 75,000. I mean, you don't need always to spend mid six figures.
No, you don't. And even a big operation like Klarovich, if you notice that the turf winner they had the other day by Real Solutions, she won a stakes race at Saratoga on the turf for Chad Brown. She was a $30,000 yearling that they purchased. You know, and you've talked about this many times about the stallions they'll go after, and here's a first crop Real Solutions that they decided to spend $30,000 on. Mike Ryan was the agent, and now a black type winner. So it's like you said, you know, and these recent examples really show you why, despite all the expertise out there, despite everything that's going on, horses are going to keep popping out from anywhere because it's really there's no magic bullet to picking up.
No, and that Real Solution winner came in the risk averse, catch a bid. So this is the thing.
Louisiana for $5,000. And he's an Arlington Million winner.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It keeps you. Hope springs eternal. Is the right?
It really does.
A terrific Saturday. There's obviously plenty more we could delve into. We'll save it, and we'll start to turn our attention toward Keeneland. Things kick off. We're staring the big fortnight, you know, right in the face as soon as Saratoga wraps up. Keeneland bubbles up on the agenda September 9th.
Yeah, I was listening to you talk to Pete about how the year goes by so quickly. it's your second half. It's really your new year begins, doesn't it, in the fall. So that kind of hit home. I know exactly what you mean.
Sid, I appreciate it. Sid Fernando, everybody. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill & Dale. And you can work with Sid and work Thoroughbred Consultants. 510-490-1111. As you're going through the Keeneland catalogs and you want some advice, you want some thoughts, you want to bounce some things off, call Sid. 510-490-1111. Approach him online or pick up the phone. Sid, thanks so much.
Thank you. Talk to you next week.
Sid Fernando. Let's take a break, and we'll bring in Paul Matisse. He just texted me, and here we come. Paul Matisse will get some real insights about how the racetrack has been playing and what he thinks we should take away from it, and what the results on Saturday, and really all meet long, what they mean from his point of view. Always one of the most anticipated conversations at any time of year. Paul Matisse next.
Latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
DRF Sports Form Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Form delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsform. Enter code DRF Sports.
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Do you ever wonder what happens to your old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years? We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and kept the summer on Afternoon Delights absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade 1 race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
HorseBills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through HorseBills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the HorseBills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. HorseBills.com. Toll-free number 888-9
We're back at the races, exactly 11 o'clock, 1 hour to fill out this Wednesday and 6 days of racing to fill out the Saratoga season of 2019. And there is no Saratoga season wrap-up without a visit from Paul Matisse, usually a visit from Paul and Duke. I couldn't make the TV version, though, Paul. That was a huge disappointment for me, but happy to get you on here this morning. Good morning.
Yeah, sorry we missed you on that Sunday. That was a good show.
Well, and appropriately made a little fun of Seth, because it's really not loose on the lead unless we're all poking fun at Seth.
That's for sure.
And he'll join us in a little bit after you and I talk. Give us, first of all, how's the meet been for you?
Well, I got off to a slow start. You know, I was the opposite. Duke came in firing, and he got way ahead. I kind of got off to a slow start, but I've been doing pretty good lately. The big thing has been I just haven't had a lot of big scores. You know, I've missed all the pick buys and when I needed them, and it hasn't been because of bad opinions. It's because it's just maybe ticket structure and situations, and you know, Saratoga situations. Basically, a lot of times I had one or two singles win, maybe even three sometimes, and still miss the pick five.
Wow.
Have five or six horses and miss it, or, you know, scenarios like the Jim Dandy was one that comes to mind, where, you know, I had Tacitus and War of Will for humongous score, for one of those two horses to win and not to win with one of those where you would, you know, lock up races that become not lock up races. But that happens at Saratoga sometimes. But so that's been a little bit annoying for lack of a better word. But, you know, I'm handicapping good, which is what I'm most happy about. I got a good, I have a better feel than I normally do at the end of a Saratoga meet, which I like.
Out of curiosity, and then we'll talk about the remaining portion of the meet, as well as, you know, particularly the track conditions and the way, you know, we're coming away with a perception that, you know, there's been a very bad rail, more or less, for the whole meet. But I do want to ask you a question about anchor legs of pick fives and pick fours. Obviously, you don't have to miss the last leg, you know, to have had a narrow miss. You can miss anywhere along the line. However, these maiden specials and maiden 40s and so forth, you know, some of these frequently, you know, head scratching types, you know, the state bred maiden races like today, we're in that race today in the nightcap where a lot of times you look at it and you have to look at the eighth, ninth, 10th contender, because the horses are so, you know, so bunched, in terms of, you know, somewhat random opportunity. You got horses in some cases that are making surface switches, that are coming back from, you know, for seasonal debuts even. You know, there's always, it seems, in those scenarios, Paul, some head scratching winners, and people come away saying, I could never have had that horse. But obviously there is a way to have them. What's your feeling about the way sequences have been ending?
Well, you know, you make a good point, and it's definitely been felt here. Because my son has been alive a bunch of times, and he's gotten very frustrated because he hasn't hit any of them in the last leg, and he's doing something that I've been trying to get him not to do is, you know, he doesn't want to lose in the last leg anymore. So I've been witnessing with somebody, and I'm trying to teach him not to, that it's just randomness and that he'll hit. But since he hasn't hit any of them, he doesn't believe me. So I understand what you're talking about, and I'm seeing it firsthand. You know, I try to keep them, you know, and for myself as well, try to, you know, not to look at it as one-offs or, you know, even, you know, that's the hardest part about pick fives and even pick fours, you know. You know, they're not four or five offs. You know, you can go a long time with betting correctly and doing the right things and not winning, you know, and I'm, you know, on a personal level, I'm having a hard time translating that to my son. But, you know, the thing about Saratoga and those races that you're talking about is that they're not lock 'em up races. You know, you can't get to a point where you say, all right, I feel good. Unless you're going to make your ticket around that horse, you know, like if you have an opinion and say, you know, I like so-and-so and I'm going to stick with him. I might do that today. I don't, you know, I think your horse has a chance to get in the gimmicks, but I do like the horse that Jeremiah claimed in the last race. And, you know, I might just go with him in that type of situation, in a race like that today. But oftentimes, like you said, and like I said earlier, you can't tie that type of race up. So what I like to do is have some kind of big spread if I'm right correctly everywhere else, you know, type of situation where I don't want to get beat if I got 20 to 1, 20 to 1, and I'm alive for, you know, have chances to get a big pot. You know, I'll take a smaller chance. Now, I have a bigger bankroll than a lot of people, so I can do something like that. But I'm only playing, you know, in that mantra that I always preach, bet a little to win a lot. I don't want you to play a caveman ticket and have, you know, eight horses or, you know, that you should never do anything like that, you know, and I'm seeing my son do that a little bit. I'm trying to, you know, persuade him out of that.
Well, and good advice. The one thing that has happened, given let maybe this past week, it just so happens that we've had pretty formful late sequences, Paul, and is some of that a function of, you know, the late season? You know, sometimes you get, you know, the fields will get a little bit smaller as you get late in the meet. What changes here. The you know you sound like you're confident about finishing strong, and you know how does your general approach to you know this last 15% of the season, you know, how does it change? How much of it is based on what's transpired the first 6 weeks, etc.? You know, talk about how players should go into these last six cards.
Well, you know, the thing about Saratoga, we talk about, because I'm on that show with you earlier in the meet. I try to stress that, you know, the excitement of Saratoga gets you to play too much early on. And, you know, I always preach that it's kind of like the new start of the new season at Saratoga. And if you don't believe so, look back at, you know, to July and what you thought about racing to what you think about it now already. You know, it seems like, and I know I'm right on this, it's the big transition time of the year where the trainers are not sitting as much. They're going to run more. You're going to find out more about what happens. I think in particular to Saratoga, I've always thought that Saratoga is a pretty formful track, probably the most formful of all the NIDRA tracks. Unfortunately, we don't run on it a lot. And I think if we ran year-round, you'd see that. I think the form would hold up even better than say, somewhere else. That's why I think the end of meet is good. One of the disappointments of the modern day era of trainers is that they don't run back. You know, like in the old days, I thought Saratoga was good because, you know, you'd see the horses run two or three times, maybe even more than that, even in a shorter meet. So the form would hold up at the end of the meet. I'm a little surprised of I know how little these trainers run nowadays, but we haven't seen a lot of horses run back yet. But what I'm expecting in the last week is, and I think this card today is indicative of it, is that we're going to see, you know, a form of all races where everybody's run at Saratoga or the major contenders have run at Saratoga. And I'm looking forward to that because I think the form holds up. I think, you know, we've had a little bit of bias here where it's the modern day. I don't like that. It's because it's not, I don't like to use the term dead rail because I think it's kind of semi-artificial. I think it's the way that the track maintenance wants these tracks to be. They don't want anybody. I had a conversation with Richard McLeory about safety, and I think they don't want people scrambling to try to get to the rail. They think more bad things can happen if that's the case. I don't particularly like it, but that's what their hand were dealt. And when we have these type of tracks, we're going to have these weak rails. So I think they've varied, you know, and makes it hard to measure, you know, who's, you know, how much of an effect that these horses are. I don't think it's a blind thing where, like, you used to be able to do in the Meadowlands and just take any horse that was on the rail and play him back the next time. It's a little trickier than that, but it definitely is something that you have to factor in going forward. But otherwise, I think the form is going to hold up pretty strong.
That gets us to a little bit of the Saturday rehash and the big day on the card, and you know, talk about how it unfolded for you, particularly jumping off the second race where the Cassie Live Oak maiden winner, if the rail was not the place to be, that 2-year-old might be Andy said this yesterday, that might be the best 2-year-old we saw. It could turn out, because if he was against the bias, he was super impressive.
Well, this is the dilemma with modern day track maintenance, right? This is the first race, and I have yet to even do this figure because I haven't had a chance to talk to Duke about it, and I'm not sure exactly what happened, but you know, I think the biggest problem is, you know, I thought about this the other day. When Andy wrote Picking Winners, or even in the Winning Horse Player book, when he talks more about bias, you're not going to see a word about how the track changed throughout the day. Or, well, you'll hear little Andy talk about it now. Well, certainly by the end of the card, it was definitely a dead rail, you know. Those words were never spoken, never thought, you know, back then, or even probably 10 years ago. I said this on with Seth when I was talking to him. They showed a replay of Blame winning, you know, the Whitney about 10 years ago, and I said to myself, hey, that's when we used to run on the rail, you know, because all the horses were close to the inside. It looked foreign, you know, because we're so used to the modern day racing. So these are the dilemmas you have, what you do with a race like this. I'm sure we'll have an answer before. I think, you know, in the old days, I would you know, subscribe to what Andy is saying. I think that's an old-school way of looking at it. My gut feeling is that the track was different for that race, that it was not a dead rail. And I don't know how that's going to, you know, how that's going to play out. I could be wrong, but my gut feeling is that the track had, might have even been even at that point, and that the track maintenance overreacted to a horse winning on the rail. Oh, we can't have a horse win on the rail. And, you know, might have done some things to make the track a little bit different. And they were worried about it. They were conscious of it and made the rail probably deader than they wanted it by the time the Travers came up. If you watch the Travers head on, you know, they are way off the rail. And, you know, I don't think we've ever talked about this, Steve, but my brother Greg, you know, who's a trainer, he always used to tell me that the horses will find the best ground. You know, when you're looking for a bias, try to find, especially on the grass, but even on the dirt, the horses will, you know, as they're running, they will just ease over to the, you know, they will find the best ground themselves. And in this modern era of these horses that where the weak rail is, I noticed that it's not only the jockeys that are coming off the rail, it's even the horses. You know, and the Travers is a great example of that to me, where the horses are know it's bad down there, and they're trying to find any chance they have. The horses kind of drift off into the paths that are better, and you can really see it on the head on this track. So I think that's the big dilemma going forward. The one thing that we do know about on Saturday is that, you know, pretty much after Promise Fulfilled, it was pretty clear that the rail was not the place you wanted to be. So from that point on, I think it'll be pretty easy to decipher going forward bias-wise, but that first race is definitely going to be trouble.
Well, and you mentioned the forego. That was the race number 5 on the day. There had been the maiden race, which went as the second. Then came the performance of Performer, and Performer rallied outside, right? He came
there was a turf race in between. So, you know, there was time to do things in between. I was actually watching to see what they were doing. The guys were on the computers in the tractors, which is another phenomenon that's interesting. You know, and that gave me a little idea, at least, that it wasn't going to be inside. But, well, Performer is a very nice horse, and I wouldn't take him lightly, and I wouldn't call him with the track or anything. That was a pretty good race. And Performers is the real deal. He'll go forward and do better, I'm sure.
Well, did you hear Shug with me on Monday when I brought up Performer? He was as excited. He seemed as excited about that as he was about winning the Travers.
Yeah, and he should be. That's a very talented horse, that, you know, and he's got turf pedigree too, right? I believe so.
Yeah.
I think that maybe if he can translate that to the turf, he's already run fast. You could see him being a turf miler for sure, you know, or even on the dirt. He's a very nice horse.
He's got a lot of options. The three stakes, of course, after Performer's win, you had the 3 7-furlong stakes, and for a figure maker, I mean, this is an ideal situation. In fact, I got an argument from somebody online who claimed that Matoli's figure was way low and should have been more like a 110, and if you give Matoli a 110 buyer, well, that skews a lot of horses that finish second, third, and fourth in the subsequent races, because, you know, how much more formful can you have, you know, three straight races with established stake horses, Paul? You know, talk about what we saw in the forego, the Ballerina, and the Jerkins.
Well, you know, first of all, in pace stuff, figure-wise, it was very easy to do for final figures. I think the tricky part may be the paces. On those three races, you know, it was colder on Travers Day. And I'm not exactly sure why, but the pace stuff kind of played like there was a wind. You know, the Travers later on is a faster pace than you would expect, and these 7 furlong sprint races were slower paces than you would expect with Quickens. You know, they had fast second quarters, but so I think I'd be careful a little bit pace wise. I don't think there was a big difference for as far as you know what you expected final result wise, but the pace stuff may alter these races a little bit different than what you might expect when they come back. I'm definitely going to be aware of that in the future. As far as the betting of those races and the way they came up, but you know, Mattioli is a good example of horses that ran on a weak rail earlier in the meet. You should have been aware of the fact that Mattioli was in a bad spot. I think it's a very good handicapping lesson. I know it wasn't a big price, but as far as handicapping lessons go, it's a very 101 basic where you have a horse last time who was inside a faster horse on a weak rail. It was going to be a bad spot for him. You saw what could happen to a very, very good horse when that scenario plays out. And then you know, on the converse, coming back where he's got an ideal situation where he's going to stalk a horse who is faster than him, and he was going to be able to, you know, sit just off him exactly where he wanted to be, and he ran back to his prior races. I think that was very predictable. I think you'll see that in racing over and over and over again. It's a good lesson. You know, this situation didn't get a lot because you're talking about Mattioli, one of the better horses in the world. So, but this type of situation happens on a daily basis, and it's a very good lesson. You should. The mistake I made personally, I know after the fact it was a lot easier because by the time later in the day that the track was, it was easier to go against Promise Fulfilled, but I was already kind of there anyway because Promise Fulfilled got an easy lead, and I thought his race was a little bit suspect. I think you and I have talked about Promise Fulfilled in the past, and I thought there was a good chance he could run out with Mattioli stalking him and putting him away, so I played it exact as 3 with 4 6, and had a brain fart and didn't play the try for some reason. I don't know exactly why. But that was costly to me in my bottom line for the. You know, I had a good day, but that. You know, you just want to get what you're when you're right. One of the things I always preach is when you're right, you got to win. You got to win a lot when you're right. You know, that's one of the concepts of betting a little to win a lot. When you're right, you better win. You know, and I felt like I kind of blew that. I was 100% right. I should have got 100% money.
Well, and you know the thing that actually personally, if we're going to talk the betting side of it, I needed Killy Beg's captain second in the world.
Yeah, me too. I mean, that's kind of if that would have been a real home run because
exactly.
I played the two of them in the exact, and it looked like we were going to get it there for a minute.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
But you know, Frenzy Fire was. You couldn't go against him either because he was on the rail. He got a terrible ride the last time he had run, you know. So the exacta paid pretty good, actually. So it shouldn't be. The try was the value, though. You know, that's how it goes.
No doubt. And for those that are I mean, the exacta was 870, Mattioli and Firenze Fire, and the try for 50 cents, 34.50. So for a buck, $75. And you know, this is a six horse field. Unbelievable. And it's funny because Airstrike to me was a toss. I was a little defensive about, you know, Bon Raison. I didn't really like, but, you know, felt like, all right, he's in.
Well, he was okay. But the thing that, you know, I'm sure you felt the same way that I was pretty certain Killy Beg's captain was going to beat Bon Raison.
You know,
so that kind of made it easy betting wise, because if you got Mattioli in the race and, you know, and there's, like you said, there's only six horses, you're against Promise Fulfilled and Airstrike, and you think Killy Beg's captain is going to beat Bon Raison, it's pretty straightforward how you're supposed to be betting it, you know?
Yep. Exactly. And all, you know, and this is one, you know, this is sort of the game within the game, you know, and this is one of the reasons, Paul, when I hear people scoff, oh, it's a six horse field. Yeah, good. It makes it that much easier for you to take an approach and leverage and strike if your opinion is good and if they run the way you want them to. I mean, that's why it's such a silly windmill tilt for people to complain. Oh, it's, I can't play it. It's old. It's a six-horse field. Okay, don't.
I might be guilty of that a little bit. You know, psychologically going in, maybe that's what that was my mistake of why I didn't play the try. I didn't take it as serious as I should have. But you know, another good handicapping lesson to for sure, certain. You know.
Well, I mean, if you're convinced that Mattoli's not losing, there's five horses now that you have to handicap into position, and if you bet a $20 try, you know, you're rewarded for, you know, $7.50. It's not.
And there's less randomness too. You know, you're taking some of the randomness out, so it becomes easier to invest more money in situations like that because, you know, there is going to be no randomness. It's basically, are you right or are you wrong? You know, and that's why I do like those situations. And I've always liked those type of situations because, you know, there isn't some random horse that could beat you. I guess you could say that Airstrike would be the random horse that could beat you. But, you know, you'd be willing to take that chance in that situation.
Come Dancing dominates the Ballerina after a bad start, and
the thing about that race that's interesting is, do you think I don't like the I'm not a giving jockeys credit or Knock'em type of person as much as my brother, but I was maybe it was possible that Castellano did that intentionally to get out. You know, if it was, it was a genius move. You know, I want to give him credit if it was. Maybe just got lucky. He either got really lucky or he was really smart in that race. Because, you know, you could take the approach into that race. You'd be against Come Dancing, especially after watching Promise of Tilt stop so bad. Worried that that she would hold a position inside and get into a bad spot. And, you know, that went out the window very quickly, you know. So that was the interesting thing about that race, not necessarily maybe from a betting spot, but you know, just was what was Castellano thinking there? Was he really in tune to what's going on and to get out and to be into the same type of spot that Mattoli was in? And if he was trying to do that, you got to give him credit. You know, that's sometimes when you're on the best horse, you got to make good moves. You know, jockeys sometimes don't get credit when they're on the best horse. You know, but that was definitely like I said, he was either a good ride or he got lucky.
Well, and even though we're going to you know, start to hear the name John Velasquez the rest of the conversation, and Johnny, you know, proceeds to reel off three wins over the next hour and a half, 2 hours, the ride on Dawn the Destroyer was also, you know, an opportunity to get her grade one black type. You know, she wasn't winning. She was a horse that a lot of people thought, you know, that seemed to be gravitating toward. Now, of course, the race changed considerably. And this is one of those scenarios where mentally you have to be in position to adjust. When it came a time for the scratches and Minute to Stardom came out of the race, it really did. You really did have to sort of rethink what was going to happen. The Pacific came out, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to do this every time. You know, you got to look at your pace scenarios when you lose horses.
Yeah, and back to my randomness argument, there was a lot of different scenarios that were playing out in my head when Minute to Stardom was in the race. I thought that a lot of different things could happen. And when she came out, I think it simplified the race more. I used both horses that ran 1-2. I thought one of the other two scenarios would happen. I was pretty much right in the race. You know, the thing about Dawn Destroyer is that if you watch her a lot, she doesn't run in the turn. If she could ever straighten that out, she's a very talented, I don't know how much longer she's going to run, unfortunately, but you might get a situation where if you know that if the turn's not important in a race she's in, she'll run good. Unfortunately, I don't know, off a second to Come Dancing, probably we probably missed any opportunity at a big price or any situation that could come out of it, but. You know, that's the way it goes. I thought I played it right. I had both horses. If Come Dancing had something bad happen to her, you know, you could have got the home run with the Dawn Destroyer. But pretty straightforward race.
Agreed. That gets us to one of the toughest equations for ticket building, particularly in the multis, where you know you're desperate. Especially given what felt like a fairly open Travers as the anchor leg for the pick five and pick four to that end, but the Chancelot decision, whether you believe that you would get away with a single and save on your budget, or whether you thought this is a huge opportunity to go against, and then you fold in that inside question, and you said you talked to Mig. Mig was way ahead of a philosophy that Jaramillo unnecessarily punished Chancelot in the Amsterdam, going to the stick when completely unnecessary, and that may have a lasting negative going into this race. What were your thoughts going in, and then what did you see once they ran it?
Well, you're not going to expect everything that I tell you here the next 10 minutes when we go over the end of this. Because I did not have this thought originally. I'm sure nobody else did. But as the day played out, I started to realize that Chancelot was a play against. Now, the way that I came about that is I thought that a lot of the other three-year-olds would go forward. And Chancelot was going to be overbet. Not that he was not going to be in the situation that warranted his odds. There was no way he was going to repeat that figure with that pace scenario on that track, that was producing these slower quarters where he could not just blast out and speed pop him like he did last time. I think that had something to do with the way he rode him last time. This modern-day riding era of, if you're going to be aggressive, you're going to have times when you're going to ride a horse harder when he wins by open lengths. And that's kind of what he did last time when he speed-popped him. He did it, though, in the middle. Chancelot does not have a huge quarter pace figure. And the thing that I really became attracted to, it's similar to Mottoli the first time he ran when he lost, that the horse just to the outside of him was faster for the first quarter of a mile, Call Paul. So he was not going to be able to, I think a lot of people misjudged that he was just going to blast off and beat this same field like he did last time. I think everybody said, well, it's the same exact field. But I think that was a shortcut of handicapping. Once you started looking at it, it was apparent to me that he wasn't going to just blast off. And the people that I was with, I said, this is an opportunity, which I didn't expect when I opened this race, or even when I got there. I think you're supposed to go against Chancelot. And I actually made a great bet in this race. I'm very proud of myself. I hit this race good. I keyed mind control. When the race went across the wire, I was okay with Chancelot being second. If he had gotten second. And as it turned out, I got lucky, and I got the Bob with Hog Creek Custom, a horse you and I have talked about a bunch of times, who's very underrated. He's a really nice horse. I would say I was a little bit lucky because of the way the race unfolded, but I think I'm also just, this is a good betting race where risk and reward. I was not shocked to see that Chancelot was going to have to be, he was at least going to have to be in a dogfight, and he was under circumstances that were not ideal for him. And he was coming off a race where it was ideal for him. And I know it was a big spread, and you had to use your imagination that he would be able to lose. But I think in racing, you have to keep in mind good setups versus bad setups, ideal situations versus tough situations, even with these better horses. I think it's a misnomer that the better horses, when they're in a tougher situation, will overcome them. And if you need any example of that, look at some of the greatest horses that ever lived when they lost. A Secretariat, when he was on a dead rail at Saratoga in a bad spot, he could lose to an inferior horse. Seattle Slough, when he faced a bad situation, you know, he proved how great he was, but he still lost. And we're betting, you know, don't lose sight when it's in with good horses that you're still in a betting game. It's in your own, you're in your own world of betting. You can have, I think a lot of people have this problem that you can have respect for these horses and think that they're great. But when it comes to betting, you have to stay in to this mode that it's your betting. It's like, you know, the people who had an idea that Keen Ice could beat American Pharoah, okay,
yeah,
were ridiculed for thinking that. But if you look at, if you bet Keen Ice every time against American Pharoah, you won because you thought in the right situation he could beat him. You have a positive ROI. I tried to explain this on Twitter one day, and I don't think anybody got it. These are the things that horse players have to do. And it's tough sometimes with good horses because, you know, these horses are great and they prove that they are better than us. But the situations dictate where you have to, you know, can it happen? You know, are the odds worth it? And this is a case where I think the odds were worth it. I mean, you got lucky that it was a situation that that the horses got up. But I still think they're good bets. They're bets that you have to make, and you have to be aware of when these situations come around.
Exactly, and being counter, to public opinion, that's the whole pari-mutuel system. I mean, that's why you're supposed to, cherish the game.
Absolutely, that's why it's the greatest game. Exactly. Yeah, that's why it's the greatest betting game, because because those situations arise, and finding them is our goal, is to find them, Now the thing that I did wrong was I played a lot of tickets singled with Mind Control, and then the very next race I get stripped down to nothing. So the highs and lows of racing were quick on me.
In other words, significant form was not prominent on any tickets.
No, I had a backup where I had an all, where I used significant form. I took a lot of heat after for not using significant form from a friend of mine. I just think that was, I think that somebody's redboarding completely on me. You know, you can make the argument she was the fifth best horse in that race. I mean, I guess it was that type of race where anything could happen, and I should have gone deeper. But this is the Saratoga conundrum we talked about earlier. You know, you make good opinions, you make a good bet, and then you got the four best horses, and you don't win the next leg. You know, that happened at Saratoga, and I think it got me. You know, I went from a very good luck situation to a very bad luck situation quickly. So, that happens.
Yeah, you had a five horse blanket finish, and the horse.
And I have the other four.
Well, I was more or less in the same. I didn't even have that many. I'm still waiting for an explanation of how Secret Message was never involved in this. The horse that at least going in I thought was the most logical horse on paper, and she's never even involved.
Yeah, but I don't think I had one the speed horse there, and I had her. That's I had three of the other. Yeah, you're right.
Crazy.
I didn't have all four, but
crazy.
Yeah, I had that one in the other three. Yeah. Well, that's turf racing, and that's miling. The one argument I don't want to get into it with you. We don't have a lot of time, and it's pointless. But that was, I think, an example of a race where the entries with having so many horses trained by the same guys and a lot of ownerships are the same, that the way the race played out, I think, had something to do with it. You could argue it all day what should be done. I think the biggest thing about that is real quickly is that a friend of mine had pointed out that betting to win, that's okay when you don't have entries and it's, when you're betting pick fives, boy, that's when you could use these entries, because it's just not it's not manageable. It's not manageable to say, well, what if this happens? What if Chad Brown runs? What if they ride this horse one way? What if they take 55 back so that his wife's horse can get a good spot in front of him? Those scenarios you can't cover in a pick five. It's just impossible.
Yeah, I get it. So. I get it. I mean,
with that being said, I'm not, I don't want to come off as a whiner either. You know, it is what it is.
Let's talk about the late pick three. And was there a reason? I mean, I ended up, again, budgetary constraint. Elate was a strong A, and I made Midnight Bisou.
You're right.
Okay, good. All right.
And I did the same thing, and I was down to a late now in the pick five when significant form won, so I had no backup, and I had to have a late. This is a, you know, obviously it was a great race. I think this is going to be a handicapping lesson, too. I could be wrong because a late's a funny horse, but I think it's a situation where, you know, a very good horse came and beat a late. I still am not convinced that, you know, I think this is a race that's going to prove over time that that we were right by taking a late. I think it was situations made it, you know, it's a hard thing to explain to somebody when Midnight Beast just beat her three times. But I think on this day, on this track, a late was going to beat Midnight Beast 9 out of 10 times. I think everything fell right for Midnight Beast, and she needed to win a head bob, you know, to beat her. Not taking anything away from her. I have never been against her. I never actually bought into the fact that she was a sprinter type thing. I've always liked that. I think I bet her in the Breeders' Cup last year. I thought she ran well in that race. The connections have done an incredible job. Asmussen, you know, has run in every dance, and you can't. And Mike Smith rode her. I mean, just unbelievably good. I can't even believe how good a ride he put on that horse.
Yep.
In that race. You know, I know he's gotten to become a great rider, but he proved it there. That was just a really great ride, and I just think circumstances, you know, you lost, and that's racing. That's how it is. But doesn't mean you did anything wrong. I think you did the right thing, and I think I did the right thing. I think Elate was the strong A. Just that's horse racing, you know. That's why we run them.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
I want to know, you know, the joke that we have is I have two friends that, you know, or I have one beside you that have had this detached retina surgery. So, I have another friend that's got another procedure, and we've been joking about, you know, calling the photos, asking those guys to call the photos. I'm going to start including you on that. Did you call that photo right?
Oh, easily. Yeah. No, that one. Yeah. The last 2-3 strides. Bisou had her measure, and Elate did not see. Sometimes you see horses lunge and really, you know, really lurch when a horse comes abreast. She did not have an answer for Midnight Bisou. I'm sorry.
Well, they would. Yeah, you know, that seems to be her weakness. You know, I don't know exactly how tough she is when she gets in situations that when she's got a dogfight or she's things that don't go all her way. She's obviously very talented. She might not be the toughest, you know, but she's very talented, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That happens. Different horses, you know, all horses are different. And I think that's a fair point. But that, you know, I don't think that takes away from her ability so much. And I think that could be tricky maybe in a situation where she runs next time where, so I don't like what I've heard what they're talking about doing. But I think you'd. To me, if I was ran a late and I got beat by Midnight Beast and I thought I had the better horse, I couldn't wait to run against her again, right? I mean, I don't care.
Sure. Just
get it on. I'm going exactly where she's running, and I hope that's what they end up doing. It'd be good for racing, and it would be a great race.
Well, that would be the Belle Dame, and why are they talking about going to the Spinster?
They were talking crazy stuff, waiting to run the Breeders' Cup, maybe running the Classic. I don't know.
Oh, that's right. I did see that. That the mile and a quarter, you know, because she's been so good going. Well, speaking of mile and a quarter, let's close out. We'll spend the rest of the segment. And Seth, I'm sure Seth is listening. Seth, we'll leave you in the green room, and we'll come back. We'll get Seth on tomorrow. Paul, that gets us to the Travers, and your thoughts going in before we talk about how it unfolded.
You know, I said the week of, you know, about a week before the Travers, I said, you know, nobody's talking about Code of Honor, you know, that was even when some of the other horses were still in it. I was always surprised that nobody, I didn't hear his name being mentioned at all, which I thought was a little odd because, you know, I was impressed by Code of Honor's race, you know, in the Dwyer, what was it, what he won?
Yeah.
The Dwyer. And, it was kind of a slow pace race that, that produced maybe a slower figure than you would expect, but it was all because of pace. And, you know, and I actually thought he overcame things. I gave him actually a plus. I thought he'd run faster than what he did. And I think you and I talked about his race in the Derby, that I thought he ran a real race. I don't think it's a surprise that he was a very talented horse. I was a little surprised in that, you know. Obviously, I thought Tacitus was the horse to beat off his bad trips. He was overbet, made the race a little hard to bet because I wasn't against Tacitus, but I didn't like his odds for his chances of winning. And I, going into the race, I wasn't 100% sure what was going to happen with the blinkers on, you know. So there was a little bit of a question mark there to take eight. What did he end up 8-5? I know he went 9-5 right before it.
He ended up at
a full 2-1.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He ended up at 240.
Did he? So, I mean, at that price, I guess it was he wasn't bad value. I was worried, you know, when he went 9-5 that he was going to go lower. But I did hit the exacta. I thought they were I thought it was the other way around. I tried to get bombs in the gimmicks and failed, you know, behind him. That was kind of my strategy of the race. Try to get to make any money. You know, I'm always looking that type of way. And I thought there was some interesting horses that maybe couldn't win, but maybe could run second, third, or fourth. And unfortunately, I was wrong. The Mucho Gusto got into a good spot. He's a pretty good horse. I don't think he didn't surprise me that he ran the race that he did either. You know, I think the race was very, but with the fact that if you take the point out that Tassis showed so much speed and the way he was ridden, otherwise the actual result isn't all that surprising to me. The going in, you could see what happened. I do think Code of Honor in this race got a good setup. I've heard some stuff that maybe he overcame anything. I don't believe that. I think he got the best trip out of all the contenders. With that being said, he beat him fair and square. He beat him, you know, pretty good, soundly. I don't know exactly how good, you know. The thing that's interesting to me about these three-year-olds is that this year we've had a lot of the, after the Derby and even beforehand, you know, a lot, you know, I guess it's the modern day era, tentative schedules with these three-year-olds, and they've all come along and they're all pretty good. You know, nobody's had this breakout. I mean, I was looking at it last night, you know, being prepared for, you know, talking to you. A lot of these three-year-olds are running the same exact figures to me, yep, which is going to be really interesting going forward. Now, I think it's a good thing that maybe this is a year that there isn't a gun runner where these three-year-olds can maybe go against each other and we could have some great races. This would be a rare case where the Breeders' Cup Derby actually would be a very highly anticipated race, you know.
So stop that.
Because I mean, we have 3-year-olds everywhere that are good,
yeah,
and but not great. They not yet anyway. I think, you know, when you've got so many of them that are this good, somebody is gonna take that next step, you know. So it's gonna be really interesting to see, you know, which one it is. But I don't think that these two horses separated themselves from the other horses, though. I don't think they're, well, all right, these are clearly the best two horses in the on the three-year-old circuit. But these are the two horses. I don't see that. I think they're very good horses. They both have upside, I think. I'm not sure we've seen the best of them, though. I think Tassis might have more upside than Code of Honor. I just get the feeling he hasn't figured out exactly how to run yet, where Code of Honor, I think, has got it down. You know, he's a good horse, and you're seeing what he's got. You know, Chug's trained him, you know, as everybody said, he's done an impeccable job training him, got him to their races. But I think it's what you see is what you get. He could go forward because he's, you know, he hasn't really been challenged, you know, in stressful situations where he's, you know, he's run in these long layoffs. But Tacitus is the one that has the most upside, but he's the one that needs to run better too to be competitive. So it's really interesting. I hope that these three-year-olds come together at some point because it's a really good mix. good mix of horses. Well, it'd be good for racing.
And the, well, the wild card, of course, is that arguably two of the division's best are only going to reemerge over the next few weeks with Game Winner in Omaha Beach. I mean, that's
right.
The craziest part of this. Sir Winston is on the sidelines. War of Will is going to be back in Philadelphia with Maximum Security. So, you know, we're looking
well,
at
we got
the
more
dozen.
Than that. You're missing some. Mr. Money has run, to me, the fastest three-year-old races of the year. He's not way ahead of these horses, but he's, to me, he's run the best. I mean, he's got a little bit of a question mark at a mile and a quarter, but if he's been very impressive. You know, Improbable ran a high figure.
Yep.
And I thought he actually ran pretty good in the race out. And I know he's not a horse who, like, you know, we've talked about this too. He's not a scrambler, so it was a good situation from the run against the horse field. You probably see his true ability. But, you know, he ran, to me, he ran very well and ran the same figure. There's a horse that Pletcher has called Spinoff.
Yep.
That won the allowance race, who ran the same, who ran really good, going a mile and an eighth in an allowance race, who's going to be heard from, you know, going forward. And to me, ran the same figure. It's a good bunch. I mean, there's a lot of them out there.
There's no doubt. And you know, that this is all separate from the Seven Furlong Gang, from the
right.
Jerkins group, that are distinct in their own right. You know, Mr. Money to me is very much on a par with like a Mucho Gusto. They seem to have, you know, kind of an interchangeability. I was happy to see Improbable come back and run the way he did. And somebody said, oh, they were laboring. Yeah, they were laboring because that racetrack out there is like running on a beach. It's like running in a sand dune, the way they've got that track engineered. So, you know,
big internal figures too. That's a nonsense thing. He wasn't laboring as far as what he wasn't laboring for, you know, six furlongs, seven furlongs. He ran monster face internal figures. So that's totally wrong,
Paul.
He might be better at that type of race anyway. I mean, that's kind of his probably ideal deal. You know, is to somewhere in that. Somewhere in that mix, but very talented in a very impressive race, I thought.
Well, we're gonna see a lot of this in Philadelphia. By all rights, the Pennsylvania Derby is gonna just shape up just to be another important confrontation. And, you know, with each passing year, now that the Haskell actually moved back a week and the time separation between the Haskell and the Travers and then the Travers to the Pennsylvania Derby, a late season Triple Crown overwrap is really, if some marketer would get aggressive and put up a Visa type, you know, late season bonus to put those three races together, it would be a score. That's a separate topic. I'll let you. You're on all the steering committees. You handle that, Paul.
Promoted some Derby series stuff. I think that's a great idea. You know, and maybe wrap it up with those three is a great idea. You know, we're not doing enough with that. You know,
summer, call it the summer crown or something, you know, call it the Indian summer crown, something.
The one thing I wanted to make a point of is, you know, the thing that I'm finding interesting in racing is that this big day mentality, you know, it's working backwards now to become an advantage for horse players, which is a thought that I never would have. You know, because these trainers aren't running as much and they're not forced to run, on a daily basis, we're seeing horses running with like 55-day layoffs and when they want to run, you know, exactly in the right situations. And I think that hurts. And this is at all tracks, not even just, you know, New York. It's affecting the handicapping where, you know, everything's ideal and that's why the prices are lower and the opportunities are lesser, but you know, because of these big days and there's not a lot to run in and you have to run in what you're talking about, like these series of races, you know, it's almost like the old days where it's more handicapping and there's more things that can go wrong and more things that can happen because all these horses are forced to run, you know, and we get to see Matoli and Midnight Beast who run more so than we would see, like, even Claimers run. You know, it's like they're the hard hitters. They're showing up at every one of these big race days, you know, and you follow them, and it's become like it's been a 180 on us, you know, like that's the point where people have to run, you know, like if I got a horse, and I know this a little bit because of Pay Any Price and some of these better horses I've had where, you know, you can't run anywhere else. You got to run in these big days or you're not going to, there's not a race somewhere else that you can run in or, you know, so I think it's and the fact that there was more money bet on these days, it's really putting that, I think you and I've talked about this before too, like the importance of these big days and betting more and spending more time in these days is going to even get even stronger. Not only just because they bet more, I think it's even because the opportunities are more because they're forced to run. The trainers are forced to run on these days, you know, like I will guarantee you Chad Brown wouldn't have had those three horses in the Travers if it wasn't the Travers. You know what I mean? There's no chance in hell he was going to run those horses, you know? So those are opportunities that don't happen. And same with these other stake races, you know,
Chancelot.
If Chancelot had some other opportunity, he might not have run back twice in the same meet, you know, or Matoli. It, you know, they're like forced to run in those races. And that's a good thing. You know, we need more of that, you know, and that's good for handicappers. And somehow if we can get this to be like even a, you know, like the old school harness, you know, what they call the Grand Circuit, you know.
Right, right.
You know, if we have this some kind of major circuit that Thoroughbred gets a hold of and, you know, markets it and makes so that even more so that these horses have to show up every time we have one of these big days, I think it would be great for horse players.
It's a point well made, actually. And, I mean, look at Jimmy Jerkins. Jimmy's going to run back Preservationist in the Woodward. And who would have thought that, you know, after winning the Suburban, that he would end up running twice more between the Suburban and the Woodward. He ended up, you know, running. It didn't go ideally, but, you know, he ran back in the Whitney because the horse was doing good, and there it was on the calendar.
If it was the one other, then he wouldn't have. He would have run in one of them. He would have picked one of them for the beat and run on it, you know. He wouldn't have he would have waited.
That's a good point.
He got the right one other than he wanted. And yet with these bigger horses now it's like we still have this situation where they're forcing the better horses to run, which is good. I mean, we can't lose sight of that. I hope that we should promote that. You know, your idea is great, you know. More of that stuff. Promote some, make sure that these guys have to run in these situations.
I love it. Paul, we got about
it's good
2 minutes.
For players.
I want to ask you, give us a ranking of the also-rans coming out of the Travers, endorsed Owendale, highest honors, tax, and looking at bikinis, who's the best of those? Who's most bettable going forward?
Well, you know, endorsed ran good. He didn't get as bad a trip as as maybe what somebody would thought. Owendale was definitely the horse who had the most go wrong for him. I'm very intrigued. He might be a horse that explodes off this race, especially if he gets time. I'm not sure he runs a lot of good races when he gets more time. That's kind of maybe the trick with Owendale. If he was forced to run him back in 3 weeks, which, you know, like we're talking about, maybe he will be. I might not be as high on him as if it falls right for him and it's got more time in between his races. But I would say him as far as those. So though, Endorse is a really interesting horse that could get better. He ran in spots and he finished well, and I wouldn't be against him either in a certain situation, and I might even be interested in him in a cutback, you know, like if he ran in a mile or
a one turn mile.
Yeah. I thought he could come from way out of it, you know, in one of those type of races and come smoking, because he definitely has that late run speed, and maybe it would be, you know, stronger with a in a situation where, you know, in a shorter distance.
Well, only two horses closed with any real authority Code of Honor and endorsed. And it should be noted, I think, and remembered that the horses that were in the 9, 10, 11, 12, you know, all the wide posted horses really had no impact on this race. Endorsed was able to out photo, Owendale for fourth, and Owendale was pinned down inside, you know, the whole way around, really. And we know that it wasn't necessarily the best place to be, but it also, you know, certainly, he didn't really get a chance to, for Giroux to get out and put the run in that they might have liked. Of course, looking at Bikinis, had the stumbled start, but
yeah, he lost our chance. He's a horse that's going to run better when he against lesser in a situation, but it's not going to be soon. It could be next year. the way Jed's on the play. But he didn't get a fair shake up here at Saratoga to show how good he is. He's better than what he showed up here.
Every time we get a chance, Paul shows how good he is. You got one for everybody today?
Yeah, I actually do. Well, Jeremiah, I think, is loaded throughout the day. You know, just I think Jeremiah is going to do good. But I think, you know, the toggle and evidently the first third that he has is supposed to be good. But my big watch list horse of the day is I like Bronco Sally in the fifth. I like that one pretty good. And
that's
Maker. And I like the Kimmel horse that's in that one turf race. I'm trying to find it. Which race is that? The third?
Kimmel's horse is Dynamite Kitten in the third?
Dynamite Kitten, third, yeah. The one in the third.
Couple of 4-1 shots. Dynamite Kitten, the one horse in the third, and Bronco Sally, the four, in the fifth. And there it is. And Jeremiah, you mentioned Munachi. Yeah, he said he thought Munachi
I've heard
was
that's,
okay.
That's supposed to be a good one, yeah.
Yeah, he just said, in fact, the article, there's an article that Brian DiDonato wrote in the TDN today, and Munachi came up. Although, how can we not like, and in fact, his client, Al Gold, is a partner, Candy Graham for Mongo. Candy Graham for Mongo. Candy Graham for Mongo. Mongo like Candy. How do you not like, come on, how do you not like Candy Graham for Mongo? Paul, out of this world. I will see you later this afternoon. I will come out for the steak.
You know, I haven't seen you once here. How's that for a long shot?
Well, you're going
to
see me today.
All right, that'll be great. We'll see you then. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah. Paul Matisse Jr., everybody. How about that? There's your hour-long analysis that people would pay for. Well, you do pay for it. One way or the other, right? Seth Merrow, I know you're listening. I feel terrible. There he is. Oh, Paul, how about my man Seth? He is listening because he just said Candy Graham from Mongo and Abby Normal. Now, we're running against Abby Normal from Young Frankenstein, of course. There's a great Mel Brooks parlay. Seth, tomorrow. We'll get you on tomorrow. I'm sorry. John Terranova earlier, Pete Fornatel, Sid Fernando, Paul Matisse. Thanks to Deja and Casey. Talk to you in the morning.